Brilliant. Thanks, Paul. Well, it's great to see you all. It's great to be in the room as well as online, and hopefully as we come out of Plan B, that'll pick up a bit in the room. But it's great to see everyone. Well, I guess one of the great rallying cries of our age is that old cry to be true to yourself, be yourself. Don't let anyone else tell you what to do or what to be. Be true to yourself. And I guess the question that comes out of that then is pretty obvious. It's who am I? How do I define myself? Where do I find my sense of identity in life? And I think it's really that question of identity that drives many of us. When I think about identity, what am I thinking about? I'm thinking about how do I think of myself? What makes me different? What makes me special? What's the role that I play in a group of people? My identity, I guess, is how I find my sense of confidence, my security. It's the lens through which I view the world. But I think often the way that we define our identity can, in some senses, narrow us. If I sort of have it fixed in my mind what kind of person I am, then it might limit who else I'm going to spend time with. If I have a particular role that I play, perhaps at work, you know, if I'm the joker of the group or the maverick of the group or the blunt person, then I'll play up to that role in meetings. I'll be constrained to play it. If I define myself by my situation, well, what happens when my situation changes? So if I define myself by my work, when I lose my work, what happens to my sense of identity? So I think, you know, in one sense, there's a great security to be found in sort of trying to state what my identity is. But I think often our sort of concepts of identity are quite limiting. We put ourselves into boxes. And I think it's that question of identity that lies right at the heart of this passage we've just looked at. Who are we and why are we here? And you can see it there, verse 26. God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the heavens, the livestock, over all the earth, every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." Who are we? Well, we're made in God's image. What are we to do? We're to do God's work, serving him as we rule over creation under him. So here then, according to Genesis, is our true identity as humanity. I don't need to make it up or conjure it or try and portray it or project it. But I'll find my identity in God. And I think it's an identity that changes everything. I think it's an identity that broadens us. As I look at myself, it gives me a sense of dignity. I'm made in God's image. It gives me a greater respect for others. As I think about my role in life, well, it goes beyond individual areas of work or whatever to everything. If I'm made in God's image to do God's work, then that will impact my view of everyone I meet and of everything I do. So I just want to dwell on this question of identity today and come at it from two angles. Yeah, who are we and what are we here to do? And we'll spend longer on the first of those questions. So who are we? Well, the first thing I think we see about identity in this passage is the dignity of humanity. And I think we'd all sort of instinctively agree on this, that there's a dignity to humanity, that humans are worthy of a certain respect. But I guess the question becomes, where does that come from? And the Bible would say it comes from this passage, that we're made in the image of God. Verse 26, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the sea." Or again, verse 27, "God created man in his own image." We're made in the image of God, and therefore we fundamentally have dignity. Because as we look at humanity, we see something of the character of God. I don't know if you've ever sort of seen a portrait that really captures someone's essence. I remember I used to do some work with a company, an investment company, that had been set up by someone who I knew quite well. He then died, and his portrait hung over the boardroom. And he had quite a wicked sense of humour. And whenever I went for these meetings, you'd be sort of sitting there talking, but his presence was kind of looming over you. And the portrait painted really captured this sort of wicked smile in the guy's eyes. And so that wicked sense of humour was always there. You could sense his presence. Well, there is something here, therefore, about humanity that means that we capture something of God's essence, his character, his image. And in creation, it's only humanity that seems to do that, according to Genesis 1. But equally, it is all of humanity, which means that as we look at each other, we see something of the majesty of God within each other. This then gives a great sense of the dignity of humanity. And as we get to this moment, as God creates humanity in the Genesis account, you can sense that something special is going on. It sort of feels as if the pace at which things have been moving through Genesis 1 slows down. The language becomes more personal. Do you know, it's a small thing, but in verse 27, Ron's saying, let there be light. He says, let us make man in our own image. It's somehow more personal. And up to now, everything in creation God has declared to be good. Now as he makes humanity, he declares humanity to be very good. So this then is the dignity of humanity. We're made in God's image to do God's work. So that'll affect our view of other people. I don't know quite what the Bible means when it talks about the image of God. There's a lot of debate about it. Is it God's morality, his conscience, his reason, our ability to relate to God? I think it's probably a bit of everything, but I think in the context it's primarily the creativity of God and our role in caring for creation. And there is something unique, something precious about humanity, therefore, as we carry on this role of working for God and doing his work. So this will affect our view of other people. Now, it's worth saying, in a couple of weeks' time, we're going to come to Genesis chapter 3, and we'll see that humanity sins, that we don't live out the role that God has set for us. And so as we look at humanity, our image of God is marred. We don't see God perfectly as we look at humanity. It's a bit like, I don't know, if you've had a cold morning this week and got out and get in the car and the car windscreen is frosted over, you can't see fully through it. As we look at humanity, we don't see a full view of God's image. We only see that in the Lord Jesus. But if we're made in the image of God, there is a fundamental dignity that we have and that others around us have. And this then is the basis of human rights. This is why throughout the centuries, Christians have been opposed to all forms of exploitation. And I think this is kind of interesting because the atheists will want to talk about human rights. In fact, I suspect a lot of the firms we work for will talk about values and rights and our perspective on humanity. Now, that is a good thing, but I don't know where the atheist gets it from. Human rights were not a thing in the ancient world before the Christian faith came to be. I mean, life was cheap. It was only really with Christianity that people began to put a value on people as made in the image of God. And so I think the thing we have to fear slightly is that as our society moves increasingly away from God, it'll move away from its reason to see people as having dignity and rights. Human rights will become increasingly arbitrary, determined by fashion, even by a power play. The strong will claim their rights against the weak. If the world is come into being just by a random evolutionary process, then if we're here because of the survival of the fittest, why protect the vulnerable? Why would we care about bullying in the workplace if people are too weak to get along? Why would we care about the rights of Christians who are being persecuted in the world if it's not a particularly trendy thing to care about? Why would we care about age discrimination in the workplace? These kind of things. If we're just purely created by a random process, why care? The danger is that human rights becomes driven by fashion. And it's important that we see as Christians that every single person we encounter is made by God, in the image of God, and therefore they have worth in and of themselves. And you can see the implication that has for our relationships, can't you? Often when we adopt a particular identity for ourselves, it reduces our circle of friends. We sort of hang out with people who we define as being like us. But this radically increases my circle of people I'll relate to, because there'll be no one that I meet who I don't expect that at some level I'm going to find something in them that I can delight in, that I can wonder at, that I can find a point of connection. There'll be no one who I dismiss and say I have nothing in common with you, because we're all created in God's image. So think of that person that you find really difficult at work, where you feel there's a character clash, where you feel there's nothing in common. Think of that department where you think they are the problem. And now think, can you see something of the creativity and the goodness and the wonder of God in them? Will you fight for them to have dignity within your workplace for all that you may have disagreements that you need to work through? So this will affect our view of others. God created man in his own image, the image of God he created them, male and female he created them. And it is important to say, you'll notice there in verse 27, there's equal dignity to male and female. and so there is no place for sexism amongst any of God's people. So we're made in God's image to do God's work. That'll affect our view of others, and it'll also affect our view of ourselves and the way we view our own identity. It's very interesting. Nietzsche declared that God was dead, but he saw the implications of that. He said that if there was no God to give us our sense of identity in life, then we would need to generate it for ourselves. He said, one thing is needful, to give style to one's character, a great and rare art. It's a lovely image, isn't it? A sort of an artist standing there filling in a piece of paper, painting a picture of themselves. And so often that's what we do, isn't it, for the outside world. We paint a picture of ourselves. We might do it on social media, through Twitter or whatever. We'll do it in the office as well, won't we? Well, the way we dress, the way we talk, the way we present ourselves, even the way we sign off our emails, all this kind of thing. We're constantly projecting an image, painting out a style. And Genesis 1 will say, well, I don't need to invent my identity. I don't need to put up a front. Rather than inventing my identity, I need to dig deeper into that identity that God has given me. Because to put it one way, his artistry is greater than mine. You know how in the old days, if artists got low on money, the canvases were expensive. So sometimes they'd take an old picture and paint a new picture over it to save money. But sometimes feel as if as humanity, we've been given this wonderful identity made in the image of God. And then we get our Sharpies out, we start painting over it and trying to correct the identity. And as we do so, we narrow ourselves, we pigeonhole ourselves by our job, our nationality, our Myers-Briggs type, the role we play in the office. And God's view of us is far richer and far less simplistic. I'm made in his image. And so I need to dig deeper into understanding what that means, rather than sort of spending all my time trying to create an image. Rather than creating an image, I find it in God. Now, I'm going to take a deep breath and just say, I think I need to say something from verse 27 about the whole kind of transgender debate. Because I'm conscious that sometimes Christians read this verse and almost use it as a sort of proof text to close down the transgender debate. So you see, at verse 27, God created man in his own image, in the image of God he created them, male and female he created them. And sometimes people say, well, that's it, full stop, that's all we need to know. Now, I think most of us working in the workplace will know that's not going to cut it. It's a very sensitive issue. Let's see what we can say positively from these verses. I think it's fair to say that no one would consider the radical implications of hormone therapy, the invasive surgery of gender reassignment, the social implications of transitioning, unless they were deeply unhappy and profoundly anxious and facing deep emotional issues. And into that context, I think we need more than just a proof text. But at the same time, I think we need more than surgery. And I think it's tragically sad when people are given purely a medical solution, because to a purely a physical solution to what really is a psychological, and I think primarily a spiritual problem. You know, let's put verse 27 in its context rather than just using it as a proof text. What are we seeing in Genesis chapter 1? Well, that our true identity, our true hope, is found in God, the God who made us and delights us, who declares us to be good. So I think as Christians in this whole debate, we can enter with compassion and offer hope. You know, true identity, true hope is to be found in the God who looks at us and declares us not just to be good, but to be very good, the way that we are made. Isn't that what so many of us are longing for? For God to look at us and say, you're very good. And so it's only in him that we'll find rest from this restless pursuing of true identity. And as such, I think as Christians, we've got something very positive and powerful and compassionate that we can say into this area. And of course, I mean, this is a wider issue. It goes way beyond gender. All of us will have moments when we wish we weren't the way we were, where we're uncomfortable with the way that we are in ourselves, where we feel a sense of guilt or shame or paralyzing anxiety, when we're restless to know ourselves and to be our true selves. And I think the solution then is not to try and change myself or my circumstances or the role I play, but to seek my identity in God, to come to him, to be confident that I made his image, and to cry out to him in prayer and seek his face. How do I do that? Well, ultimately, I find my true sense of identity in the Lord Jesus. He is the ultimate image of God. So look, if you looked onto Colossians chapter 1, You may remember there that Jesus is described as the image of the invisible God. We're told that he is the one in whom the fullness of God dwells in human form. You know, if we are marred by sin, then when I look at Jesus, I see my true identity as one made in the image of God. So what does it look like to dig deeper into that identity, to seek it? I think it's to fix my eyes on Jesus. He's the full image of God. So, you know, if you've got teenagers at home, as I know some have, you go into their bedroom and you probably see posters on the wall, right, of whichever hero they happen to be chasing after at the moment. So is this true, yeah?
Pretty close.
Yeah, and you know, if it's a musician, there'll be a poster of a musician. If they're into sport, a little bit, a poster of a sportsman or whatever it is. And they'll try and emulate them. Or maybe they head off to university and they come back and they've suddenly developed a new set of mannerisms. You don't understand it until you meet their lecturer or their roommate or someone. You suddenly realise who it is they're beginning to impersonate. I went through a phase in lockdown of watching some Seinfeld episodes back to back. I suddenly found myself doing impressions of Jerry Seinfeld. It's very weird. You know, you sort of emulate whoever you're following at the time. Well, let's look to Jesus and look at him and see his compassion, his power, his majesty, his love, his gentleness. Let's see the one who gave up the riches of heaven to come into this world to die on the cross that we might be forgiven. And as we do so, we're going to look at him and say, that's what I want to be like. That's the image that I want to present to the world. And that is what wonderfully God has called us to be. To be truly human is to be truly Christ-like. So let's set our eyes on him. We're made in the image of God to do God's work. That's the dignity of humanity. I'm aware that some of us, we like to define ourselves by what we do rather than what we are. And so, secondly, much more briefly, let me say that what we see in these verses is not just the dignity of humanity, but there is a dignity to our activity. What is it that God calls us to do? Verse 26, God said, "Let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish and the birds of the sea and the heavens and over the livestock and all of the earth and every creeping thing that lives on the earth." You see, there are two commands here. To be fruitful and to subdue the earth, that is to rule over it under God. We serve God by ruling creation. And so there's a dignity to all of our activity. It's a bit like if someone goes away who's got a lovely garden and they go away over the summer and they get us to house it. And as we look after the garden, we're enjoying it. And yet at the same time, we're serving them by watering it. I think that's the kind of picture here. God gives us this world to enjoy. And at the same time, we care for it for him. So there's a sense of responsibility, but also of privilege. And there's a real sense of abundance here. I mean, I don't know if you notice, these verses are quite repetitive. So verse 26, he talks about how we rule over the fish and the birds and the livestock and the creeping things. Then again, verse 28, we've got dominion over the fish and the birds and the living things. Verse 29, all the plants on the face of the earth, the trees, the seed, and so on. It keeps talking about all these living things on the earth. Why? I think because it's just this sense of abundance. We're made in God's image to do God's work. And what a joy to have this fruitful, abundant creation to look after. Now, this has got all sorts of implications because it means that the whole of my life then is caring for God's creation. And this broadens, I think, our identity, because everything I do relates to this created world, not just a particular activity I define myself by. So whether it's my relationships with other people or bringing up the next generation, or I think particularly in the context of Paddington Talks, our work has real value, doesn't it? Because it is caring for creation. Whether we are in the hospital or in a bank facilitating people moving cash around or working for a fuel company or working for Vodafone and enabling people to communicate, wherever we fit in, our work is more than simply paying the bills, or indeed more than the money we can earn to give away to church and the opportunities for evangelism. Our work in and of itself has value because it's part of being made in God's image to care for God's creation. So everything we do has dignity. The same, by the way, is also true, of course, of our care for the environment. Often people try and encourage us to care for the environment by scaring us about what will happen. The Bible encourages us to care about the environment by telling us that actually we've been given it by God, and therefore our motive is not fear so much as the desire to please God. Now again, we need to be clear, this world is fallen. We'll get to that in chapter 3. So if God gave us this world to look after, we've failed, which means we're in this peculiar situation, because on the one hand, I'm here to serve God by caring for his world, but I know that I can't make heaven on earth. On the other hand, I'm not yet in heaven. So what does it look like to work for creation? Well, I think day by day I get on with my work, but my heart is longing for heaven. So the work of us now as humanity is to care for this created world, but also to work by calling people to the world to come. The best illustration I could think of it was to imagine a couple of pilgrims back in the 17th century about to head off to America, and they're working as blacksmiths. And during the week, this 4 weeks before they go to America, they keep going on their day-to-day job, doing their work in the forge. But as they do so, they're talking about this great new land they're going to come to. So as Christians, we work hard as those caring for God's created world, but we also work to point people to the new creation that's the ultimate world to come, if that makes sense. And I guess that's what we would love to be known as at Pannington Talks. We'd love to be known as workers who take our work seriously and who care for our work. All of us have vocational jobs, and yet at the same time also to be those known as those who long to make Jesus known and point forward to him. So that's some thoughts from Genesis chapter 1. We're made in God's image to do God's work. All of us, I think, are constantly trying to seek to say something about our identity, who we are ourselves, and the image we project. But ultimately, we're in God's image. And any other image or identity we pursue will disappoint us. It will narrow us. And I think what these scriptures do is to call us to find our identity in Christ, to know his approval, and to declare his glory in this world